1,000 people at HHS, and are you suggesting that some of them should not be held responsible for that decline? They were in charge of protecting our health.
Let me just say this, because I only have 3 minutes left. I don't set the rules here, but I ask the questions. And the question is really whether you intend, as you said, to substitute essentially your judgment for the judgment of these professional scientists. And
I'm not going to substitute my judgment for science. Of course, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do, listen, the New York Times just did an article last week talking about the fraud, the 20-year fraud, 800 fraudulent studies produced by NIH on amyloid plaques and not allowing any other hypothesis about the cause of Alzheimer's.
Well, how will you decide, Mr. Kennedy, which scientists?
The ones who disagree with you? The ones who are corrupt. The ones who have been doing science like the amyloid plaque studies that were fraudulent.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have a medical degree?
Do I know?
Okay, let me go to the next question. The Heritage Fund has compiled a watch list of federal employees to go after federal staff. Is there a watch list for federal staff at HHS?
Not that I know of.
Have you or has anyone in the administration developed a list of career scientists or federal staff that you would target for termination?
Not that I know of.
And let me just ask you another question. Now, your failed presidential campaign has been raising money to try and cover your debts. And you were questioned about this yesterday and failed to answer a question that Senator Warren asked you. And so I want to ask you again regarding these emails that you have sent to raise money. How much has your presidential campaign made fundraising off of this administration's complete disregard for the workforce at HHS?
Excuse me? I didn't hear the question. The last part.
How much money has your presidential campaign made off of fundraising, off of this administration's complete disregard for the workforce at HHS?
Zero.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask unanimous consent to enter into the record two emails from this week and the week before regarding fundraising that you are currently doing through your presidential campaign.
Without objection.
And finally, I want to ask you, you were on a show on February 26, 2021, an interview with Dr. Judy Mikovits, where you said the following, and I quote, "We should not be giving black people the same vaccine schedule that's given to whites because their immune system is better than ours." Can you please explain what you meant?
There's a series of studies, I think most of them by Poland, that show that to particular antigens that blacks have a much stronger reaction. There's differences in reaction to different products by different races.
I have 17 seconds left. Let me just ask you then. So what different vaccine schedule would you say I should have received? What different vaccine schedule should I have received?
I mean, the Pollen article suggests that blacks need fewer antigens than.
This is so dangerous.
So you get the same measles vaccine.
Mr. Kennedy, with all due respect, that is so dangerous. Your voice would be a voice that parents would listen to. That is so dangerous. I will be voting against your nomination because your views are dangerous to our state and to our country.
I mean, do you think science is dangerous, Senator? This is published peer-reviewed studies.
I yield.
That was from Roland Martin, Unfiltered. And continuing on.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Don Lemon Show. We're so glad that we could have you this week. President Donald Trump signed a memorandum directing the federal government to prepare the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, known as Gitmo, of course, to house some tens of thousands of migrants that have been rounded up on the streets of America. So the order calls for the Defense and Homeland Security Departments to provide detention space at Guantanamo and for, I quote here, high priority criminal aliens unlawfully present in the United States. So what is going on here. I want to talk with the editor of Law Dragon and the author of the book America's Trial, Torture and the 9/11 Case on Guantanamo Bay. John Ryan joins us, an award-winning legal affairs journalist as well. John, thanks so much for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You are at Guantanamo Bay right now.
I am. I've been here for close to 2 weeks for this latest trip, and this is probably my 55th trip overall.
Okay. We're going to talk about what's happening at Guantanamo Bay, but what exactly is going on here as it relates to this overall story of some 30,000, if not more, migrants or, undocumented immigrants being placed in Guantanamo Bay?
Yeah, right now it's a little bit of a wait and see because it caught a lot of people by surprise. And so right now there's physical space on this base for that many people if they wanted to, but there's not the infrastructure for it. So it's a little unclear how this is going to unfold and how quickly. It almost certainly would require funding from Congress. So people are kind of waiting and seeing and asking a lot of questions.
What happened? What was the reaction from the folks there when this news came out?
Well, it traveled pretty fast. This is a pretty small naval base. It has about 5,000 or so people now, and I think it caught people by surprise. There's only two members of the media here now, me being one of them, but with the other lawyers and other people on the base, I think it caught people by surprise. I think people had thought about this potentially happening because Guantanamo is sort of associated with detentions, but it still seemed to catch a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, and look, and one would wonder, it caught a lot of people by surprise. Why is the United States suddenly in the business of concentrating thousands upon thousands of black and brown people in a camp?
Yeah, I mean, almost immediately, the advocacy groups that work with immigrants and other populations were pretty outraged that this had happened. For that reason, I think it has... The concern is that it has that flavor to it, even if what really matters is sort of how it's executed. But people who are familiar with other detentions that have taken place here, have understandably expressed really, really colorful concern.
Let's walk me through then the memorandum Trump signed earlier this week, if you will.
Well, right now, it's pretty bare bones. It's saying that the worst criminals identified by the administration currently in some type of deportation proceedings or that get caught up would be the ones selected to come here. And then the other comments is that it would more or less double the available bed space for migrants that are being rounded up. So that's a pretty simple way of explaining it. The memo itself is pretty short. How they go from this base, which is mostly empty and does not have the capacity for that many migrants, how it goes from space for maybe 100 or so to 30,000 is just a huge question. And so the memo really doesn't provide a lot of answers. I think that is all hopefully in some sense forthcoming.
Well, that is a question. You're there, and you talk to the staff, I would imagine. So does Guantanamo Bay even have the staff or the resources to be able to hold 30,000 migrants?
No. No, that wouldn't be possible right now. I think where migrants have been held, which is on the other side of the base, from where I am now, you would cross the bay, and that's where Migrant Operations Center, where that has been. There is physical space across the 45 square miles of this base to hold a lot of people, maybe that many, but there aren't 30,000 beds. There's not a facility for 30,000 people in that area. It's mostly empty. So it would take a lot of not just the infrastructure, but the staff, of course, to run a large detention facility like that. And that isn't here yet at the time. There is a staff, of course, still working for the prison for war on terror detainees. But those people, as far as we know, there wouldn't be any sort of movement of them to this operation if it happens.
John, their reaction from a lot of folks online and just from the general public is that this is essentially going to turn Guantanamo Bay into a concentration camp. And others are saying, well, it is already a concentration camp of sorts. What's your take on that?
I think a lot of it depends on how it happens, but I can tell you that for people who have represented detainees for over the years, this would cause alarm because of the protracted nature of the detentions, although most of the war on terror detainees have now since been moved to other countries. But the reputational problem with Guantanamo Bay would almost certainly create additional trauma for people being moved here because...
Can you explain the reputational thing? Because I think people forget that the allegations, and I think found true, of torture, et cetera, at Gitmo.
Yeah, there was torture in earlier phases of Guantanamo Bay when detainees were first sent here. And then there were detainees that were tortured elsewhere at CIA black sites and then brought here. And of the 780 or so detainees that have been here, most were never charged with a crime, and many spent long periods of time here. And most now have been released, you know, but many obviously had years of detentions in which their lawyers thought was unlawful because they had never been charged with a crime. And so that history of prolonged detention without the same legal rights as people in the United States, and then some of the earlier mistreatment of people who have been here, I think that is the reputational environment in which this is going to unfold.
Yeah. Well, can you talk to us since you're there? Tell us about the conditions in which these undocumented people will be kept.
Right now, we don't really know. The fastest way to build a migrant detention facility where they've had other migrant operations would be something like a tent city. That's one possibility where that would be sort of the fastest way to do it. But that would pose a number of problems, including weather. You know, there's hurricanes that hit here and stuff like that. So I just don't think we know enough when it comes to how quickly they would build a facility and kind of what type of facility it would be physically and how they would staff it.
So we don't know if the folks that are going to be held in the same facilities as the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay who have been accused of terrorism, right?
That's correct. And so we know, and Secretary Hegseth has said that this is going to be a separate operation. So on one part of the base, there is still the prison that has held the suspected terrorist detainees for a long period of time. That will be separate from whatever migrant operations is built probably on the other side of the space. And so they will be separate for separate reasons, for separate end purposes. So that is one thing that may be being muddled now. Right now, at least as far as we know, the Trump administration is not planning on putting migrants with the war on terror detainees.
Yeah. So journalists have pointed out, and I want to get your take on this, what you think of as a journalist, with the this is especially concerning in light of the passage of the Lake and Riley Act. Can you speak to that, and why are folks linking these two things?
Yeah, I don't really know. There's a lot of, it seems intentional in terms of even with this move, they're describing these migrants as sort of the worst of that population, and that was sort of how the Bush administration described the initial detainees that were sent here. They were the worst of the worst. And so there are so many things different about the situations that it probably is dangerous to link them. I think they will be because of, like we talked about before, the reputation that Guantanamo Bay has.
Yeah. Just that Lake and Riley is 22 years old, from Augusta University nursing student, was murdered while she was jogging at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. And they are saying that it was obviously done by someone who was here illegally in the United States. And so they came up with the Lake and Riley Act. A man who entered the United States illegally was arrested by UGA police and charged with 10 counts, including felony murder, malice murder, false imprisonment, and then other charges. So what is the connection here? Do you think that's justification for them to be able to put folks in a facility that may have harsh conditions and using this to sort of soften the Americans' attitudes about it?
I don't know. I think one of the problems, as we talked about, of sort of linking these two things is that they really don't have much to do with each other. But I think the language that's being used will sort of muddy this issue. But there are already processes in place to deal with the convict in that case, right? And so those processes are in place. What we don't know is what would be different from building a new facility, let's say in Colorado, and having migrant detainees sent there versus having them come to Guantanamo Bay. Will they have fewer legal rights, fewer access to counsel because they are here? And I think that is a concern. I don't think we know. What is, you know, the Trump administration trying to replicate what would happen in a different facility, but they're having it here because they feel like it's a more secure location? Or is it a way to sort of get into the legal black hole that Guantanamo Bay has been for at different periods?
Yeah, so they can maybe flout the law and sort of human rights issues. By the way, the Laken Riley Act is a law that mandates a federal detention of illegal immigrants who are accused of theft, burglary, assaulting a law enforcement officer, and any crime that causes death or serious bodily injury. Journalists have pointed out that this move is especially concerning in light of that passage, and they're linking the two, and that's what we're talking to John Ryan about. John, how did the dehumanization of migrants become so normalized? Do you think that, you know, this is insane? They've ratcheted this up even from just calling people illegal aliens.
Yeah, I think the rhetoric of the last campaign was really effective. And I think they really preyed upon people's fears of the increased numbers of people coming into the country. And that was successfully played upon during the last campaign. And, you know, there is, I think, justification for the Trump administration to say that this is what people voted for. It's way more complicated than that. But there is a version of this that people have, in a sense, voted for. So I think they're using that mandate, however more nuanced it should be, this concept of a mandate to really push this stuff forward incredibly quickly.
Just in general, when you're looking at for the general public and for Americans, what do you think the ramifications of this, if the Trump folks, Donald Trump and the administration, if they do go along with and keep their promise of sending these folks to Guantanamo Bay, at least 30,000 of them, what do you think the ramifications are for the country?
I think it'll be a really complicated legal mess that could drag on for a long period of time. And the current Guantanamo situation, which is focused on war and terror detainees and some of their criminal cases, that has been a legal fiasco that has dragged on now for more than two decades. And so I think if you have people sent here in those numbers, you're going to have the human rights community really up at arms. They already are. And I think it's going to be just an unpredictable, but unpredictable in terms of the claims and the arguments and sort of the nature of the treatment, but predictable, and that'll be a real frenzy, I think, of litigation that could really be a headache for the Trump administration, where there may be a simpler, almost certainly there's a simpler solution than flying 30,000 or however many people there are to this base, which is incredibly remote. It's hard to get anything done here. It's hard to run a court here. It's hard to have the power stay on for, you know, a week straight. So doing this on Gitmo now, with the current level of infrastructure, is just, it's hard to see the end of that, because getting there successfully, it just seems like a massive, massive challenge.
John Ryan, an award-winning legal affairs journalist and co-founder of LawDragon.com, the editor, as a matter of fact, of LawDragon.com, also the author of America's Trial, Torture, and the 9/11 case on Guantanamo Bay. Be safe. Thank you for joining us. Hope you'll come back.
Don, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Now let's go to the parking lot with Lene.
On Wednesday, a plane headed from Kansas collided with a military helicopter over Washington, D.C. 67 people died. There were no survivors. Passengers included top figure skaters from the U.S. and Russia, a young professor from Howard, a lawyer, and a young pilot. And you raggedy bitches blamed it on DEI? When discussing the crash, Trump cited old, outdated, and scientifically voided eugenics ideology when he said regarding the Federal Aviation Administration, we have a high standard. And there are things where you have to go by brain power. You have to go by psychological quality that the various, very powerful tests that we put to use to test employees were terminated by Biden. All this after generalizing Biden's diversity efforts by saying that he said FAA was too white. And it's clear to me, by the way, DEI is being weaponized in this current moment that the conservatives are trying to die on the hill that DEI is affirmative action hiring without any consideration of qualifications or fitness for a position. This is evidence again when just the day before the crash, 19 attorney generals sent a letter trying to bully Costco into abandoning DEI, warning them to stop their pushback after Costco has already said twice, girl, you. In this letter, these attorney generals expressed the following: an urgency for Costco to end all unlawful discrimination imposed by the company through diversity, equity, and inclusion. Huh? That Costco should treat every person equally and based on their merit rather than based on divisive and discriminatory DEI practices. Divisive and discriminatory DEI practices is an oxymoron. And as I was reading this letter that cited the constitutions and the foundations of equality and all that jazz, it reads very clearly to me that what the government means by DEI and what Costco and the rest of us mean by DEI are two different things. A simple Google search revealed to me that on page one of their document outlining their commitment to DEI, it says that they strive to empower their workforce and strengthen their culture by creating an environment where all employees feel a sense of belonging, that they are accepted, included, and respected and supported because of who they are, regardless of who they are. Interesting. Then it goes on to say, it has always been Costco's policy that employees deserve an environment free of all forms of unlawful employment discrimination, that all decisions regarding recruiting, hiring, promotion, assignment, training, termination will be made without unlawful discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, ancestry, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, religion, age, pregnancy, disability, work-related energy, covered military or veteran status, political ideology or expression, genetic information, martial status, or other protected status. Mind you, this is the first paragraph. Their efforts to create an inclusive and respectful workplace include, but are not limited to, a chief diversity officer, conversation starters on topics like unconscious bias, microaggressions, allyship, and the like, giving these folks an additional holiday of their choosing, whichever applies to them, Juneteenth, Indigenous People's Day, or Veterans Day. They even offer a race-based breakdown of their workforce composition, and on both the management and non-management sides, it's still majority white, in keeping with the percentage of the white population in the United States. Crickets? Oh, okay. So my question is, how many attorney generals does it take to review a DEI policy? But oh, we can only make sense out of nonsense if they were being earnest in their claims to halt race-based discrimination. Do you know they told Costco that instead of worrying about DEI, they need to worry about the slave labor in China they've been accused of doing? I know y'all lying. Not when a man known to use slave labor in the Congo was standing behind a podium on Inauguration Day, and a man who used exploitative labor to ensure Americans benefit from two-day and even same-day shipping was right beside him. JP Morgan Chase also said no, and y'all don't seem to be on their asses. I wonder why that is. Now, of all the people that did buckle under pressure, Target is the most surprising to me. And that's only because we burned their shit down twice over police killings in 2020. And the CEO stuck beside us even then. Y'all been partnering with and uplifting black business owners, products, and influencers, standing on business for years, and all of a sudden you just want to pull the rug out from underneath us? And y'all mad at Tabitha Brown? Yeah, she's got Donna's hair care, but the majority of her products are Target and a Walmart online. What, you expected her to have a contingency plan? Would she find it the same time, the same way we did? Yeah, we can boycott because that sounds cool, that sounds revolutionary. But these things take time and effort and evaluation of how they will affect our people and our communities that rely on these resources. Yes, I know that's how it works. I know they are counting on us to be dependent on them, but they are not counting on us to play the long game and create avenues to ensure every individual in our community is able to sustain efforts of resistance. There's also more than one way to skin a cat, people. We can boycott Target altogether, sure. Or we can only purchase minority-owned products from them, creating a flux in supply and demand that would severely impact the health and stability of their business. However, still, black people only make up 15% of the population, so it's got to be more than us. Everybody affected has to lean in, and we have to do it together. The steamrolling is scary, and it seems to be relentless, but it is slowing down, so do not be discouraged. Give the people and yourself an opportunity to adjust and resist.
The new Pittsburgh Courier presents the Legacy Award. Doris Carson Williams, CEO of the African American Chamber of Commerce of Western Pennsylvania, is a trailblazer committed to advancing opportunities for African American business owners. She also serves on the Highmark Board as vice chair of the Highmark Foundation and has held leadership roles, including chair of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. A distinguished daughter of Pennsylvania, Doris is dedicated to community, civic engagement, and creating lasting change.
My sister has always been a great inspiration to me. Seeing her as I grow up, seeing her in her leadership roles, seeing her being a dedicated person, a servant leader, but more importantly, a compassionate person that makes people feel great, respected, and welcome. That's really part of what she is so good at.
You go to the office, you'll see all the awards and things that she's done. And not just that, even a proclamation that she's got from the governor, county executive, the mayor, and the name of the chamber. A phenomenal woman who grew a chamber from, 28 paid members to over 670 members, which is amazing. She got up to the seventh largest chamber in Western Pennsylvania, in the Pittsburgh region.
I met her in the 70s, and she was involved in business development back then. That's 50 years ago. So she's been at this for a long time. And I think that the time that she's put in, the impact that she's had on the community, the people who have benefited from her efforts, all brings us to a point where she should be celebrated. And I am so happy that this Legacy Award is being presented to her.
If I could count the number of individuals, of those lives that she's impacted, we would be here all night. She has touched people in various ways. Personally, professionally, academically, socially, from nonprofit status to corporate environments. So she has really left and touched, made an indelible touch on people's lives.
Before I met my wife, I was a single dad with two little girls. And having a positive role model that they can actually see and talk to goes a long way. That goes, she speaks volumes. So I know that helped my daughters achieve their goals and what they're going through because they got to actually meet someone who was successful.
The connections that she has created for small business people, in particular with the larger corporate community, so that it created a larger marketplace for them. I think that's been one of her greatest achievements.
When I think about my sister Doris, I think about three C's. The letter C. A, she's always been called to do great things. She has been committed. Whatever she says she's going to do, she's been committed to do. And she's been compelled to achieve at the highest level. And so all of those characteristics would be a testament to who Doris is today.
Next up, we have Karen Hunter.
Introducing a new podcast, Karen Hunter is Awesome.
If you like me on SiriusXM Urban View Channel 126, you're going to love me.
And Karen Hunter is Awesome.
Hey, this is Karen Hunter, host of the Karen Hunter Show on SiriusXM Urban View. Karen Hunter is Awesome is an actual podcast to bring heat and energy and knowledge and power. A one-two punch that I don't think you get anyplace else.
Tell the truth.
So check out the podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, you will not be disappointed.
Karen Hunter is Awesome, a new podcast from Karen Hunter.
The mantra should be, are you good with this? Are you okay with this? Are you okay with this? Yelling into the void is not going to change it. What are you willing to do about it? Joe Madison would ask that question every day. What are you going to do about it? And what I know for certain is that chaos needs fear to thrive. Chaos needs fear and more chaos. It's like feeding a log into a fire. So how do you douse chaos? You douse it by starving it of oxygen. That's how you put out a fire. There's a couple of ways. Water, good water. We pour clean glasses of water every place we go. I don't know if it's a fire hose of water. But starving it of oxygen, which means that you have the ability to calm yourself. So I want to start off. I'm going to play a few clips this first hour. Jon Stewart has a daily show that he does. I don't watch it, but I do get the clips from it. That's how Smiz pulls the clips, and that's how we get them on the air. But he made some points that I think we should listen to. And I am someone that believes in chewing up the meat and spitting out the bones. Whether I agree with somebody or not, if I can learn something from them, I am going to value the knowledge. Play the first Jon Stewart clip, Smiz.
Now, look, I have a lot of fear that as this term goes on, things are going to get a little fascist-y. And we must be vigilant. But part of vigilance is discernment. Republicans control the House, the Senate, the executive, and the judiciary. And just about every move that has been made till this point, we have granted them electorally. It's our f***ing fault. And the constant drum, yeah, it's just our fault. And the constant drumbeat of encroaching fascism will erode the credibility we will need if, hopefully if, and not when, it hits. But the truth is that for now, his most objectionable actions have taken place almost entirely within our designed democratic system.
I'll remind you that Hitler came to power through a democratically elected position. So there's that. There's that, John Stewart. There's that. But there are some things happening, and it requires something of us. It's not just what you're going to do about it. What you must not do also, in addition to starving the chaos of oxygen, and by that, don't feed into the fear, we also must speak up when bad things are happening. You can't be silent. Silence is what? Acquiescence. We learned that word last week. Acquiescence. Silence. Your silence is acquiescence. You're saying, I am okay with this, by not speaking out. So I want to shout out, yesterday it was Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg, the daughter of JFK and Jackie Bouvier Kennedy. Her cousin is up for a seat as our health and human services person. And her family's not staying quiet. His sister came out today and said, no, he is not fit to sit in that seat. And all of those senators at the Senate hearing, the confirmation hearings, amazing. I'm going to play a bunch of those as well. But before I get to them, again, it requires something of us. I'm going to play this. Cat Williams has made an appearance. It wouldn't be January in the end times if Cat Williams wasn't part of the conversation. I just feel like, I don't know, this man has been ordained to say some things. Some things are wild, but some things are spot on. I can't tell. But in this clip, he does a sit down with Theo Von, who I know from one of these Real World Road Rules MTV shows. But now he's a very popular podcaster, I think, you know, in the vein of a Joe Rogan. And so they sit, and he also fashions himself as a comedian. So Cat Williams is sitting with him, dressed very dapperly. And he says something about rappers being federal informants. But that's not the part that I want to focus on. But play the clips, Miz, and we'll talk about it.
But do you feel like they would say to someone, okay, we're going to bring you in unless?
Absolutely. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even like in the rap world, like all of the rappers that you know that never been to jail and never gotten any trouble with the law, but they talk as if their life is opposite of that. Like, those are federal informants, like, you know.
You think they're really out there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's part of the job, is to acquire those. It's like saying, you know, if you're playing chess, do you have any pawns? You have to, don't you? You can't start without them.
That's the part I want to focus on. I don't know if the rappers are informants. I don't really care at this point because I don't put a lot of faith in rappers. Rappers are not my leaders. But when he said, when you're playing chess, the pawns are in the front and you can't play chess without them. And I've been saying, I don't want to play this game. I want to play another game, or I don't want to play a game at all. We're talking about people's lives and livelihoods. I don't even want to play a game. I'm not playing chess. These aren't chess moves that we're making. These are life moves. I'm not sitting here trying to figure out, you know, which way I'm going to be righteous, which is due north. That's an easy, easy road. You know, it's going to be few on it, but it's an easy road to walk, to place humanity at the forefront and be righteous in the things that you do and say. Do I get it right all the time? No, but that's the goal. I'm not playing a game. So, yeah, if you're playing a game, then, yeah, there are pieces on the board, and you got to know the rules and all of that. And as these people are showing us, it doesn't matter what the rules are. They are making it up to see what they can get away with. And right now, as John Stewart pointed out, they have all branches of government. I tweeted out, this is a hard lesson, hard way to learn civics. I tweeted that out. It's like almost got 100,000 people done seen that. It's a hard way to learn civics. They have all branches of government. But we don't live in government. You and I, we live in neighborhoods, in communities with people. The government's intrusion into our lives happens when there's a tragedy and we need government assistance. If you're on public assistance and you need government to pay for your housing or your medicine or whatever. So it does definitely impact millions of people. But for the most part, where we live every day in those governments, we have our local governments that will service our needs. Now, yeah, those of you who are on Medicaid and, oh, my goodness, Head Start and all of these government programs yesterday, their money would stop because this administration that people didn't show up for or showed up for, or maybe the machines were rigged, I don't know, but they're in office right now, flipped the switch, and shut down all funding. And it hurt a lot of people, hurt a lot of governments. I'm going to play some clips because I think you should know what's going on. Let's first go to Governor J.D. Pritzker, who could have been Vice President Harris's running mate. He was up for that. Illinois Governor J.D. Pritzker. He said this about, sorry, Smith. Let's not play that one first. Let's play Tim Walz, who was the vice presidential running mate. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said this about the freeze.
Donald Trump's reckless action cut off funding to law enforcement, farmers, schools, childcare, veterans, and health care. While he was out golfing, he threw the country into crisis. This is not bold. It's not leadership. It's stupid, buffoonish, childish of exactly what they did. Childcare providers across the state, law enforcement, our prisons, things that we count on. Individuals on Medicare, things that we know matter to people's lives. And I want to be very clear about this. Minnesota is a state that pays far more into the federal government than we get back. Those are our dollars that he is stealing unconstitutionally. Congress, as I served, as Attorney General Ellison served, appropriates the dollars. This is so far beyond the pale to try and pull these dollars back. And the real thing about this was he has no idea. I understand this. Donald Trump has no idea the implications on this.
Yeah, because he never needed any. Everything was handed to him, and his hands are soft. He's never really had to work and scrap and scrape for things. But for the people in this country, the majority of the people in this country have had to scrap and scrape for everything. Yesterday is a foreshadowing of more to come. They're just in the house. They got in the house and just started hitting buttons and flipping switches and turning things off because that's what they do. I remember when Elon Musk took over Twitter, took out the toilets and all. I mean, just was making a show of it. This is a publicity stunt, but it's also you want to see how far you can go and how much people will allow you to get away with. Well, we have voices, and it's our responsibility to say, no, this is not acceptable. And no matter what the outcome of these elections, you're not king. So I brought up J.D. Pritzker because of the enforcement of the immigration deportations. But before I play that, part of the government shutdown, part of the DOGE department of office of whatever the hell Elon Musk is head of, they're trying to, you know, drain the swamp and cut back expenses. That's not the problem. That's not the problem. So what they're doing is offering people packages. This is what they say they're going to do. Offer people packages to, you know, leave on their own volition. And Tim Kaine, who was a vice presidential pick by Hillary Clinton, a Democrat from Virginia, said, please ignore the offer. If you are getting an offer, if you work for the federal government, please ignore the offer before we get to that. By the way, they had to turn the lights back on and rescind the freeze on the money because it was harming too many people in the red states. It's harming your people. All right, play the Tim Kaine clip.
And they received an email that said, from the administration, if you tender your resignation by next Friday, we will guarantee you payment through the end of September, whether or not you show up for work. So tender your resignation And then, boy, it's just going to be a gravy train. You're just going to get paid for 7 months without working. The president has no authority to make that offer. There's no budget line item to pay people who are not showing up for work. This is a guy who made this promise to contractors again and again and again when he was a private business guy. Oh, come work for me on my casino. Come work for me in a hotel. We're going to do a handshake. We're going to do a contract. The contractor does the work and then finds out they get stiffed. So my message to federal employees who receive this is, yeah, the president has tried to terrorize you for about a week and then gives you a little sweetheart offer. If you resign in the next week, we're just going to pay you for doing nothing for the next 7 months. Don't be fooled. He's tricked hundreds of people with that offer. If you accept that offer and resign, he'll stiff you just like he stiffed the contractors.
Right.
He doesn't have any authority to do this. Do not be fooled by this guy. You were here before he was here, and you'll be here after he was here. Show up for work. Be diligent. Serve Americans every day. Make their life better. Answer their phone call. Give them an answer. Track down their constituent call. Don't be fooled by a fake offer that because he's terrorized you in the last week, it would be easy to just resign now and get a check for 7 months, because I can tell you that promise is worth nothing.
You know, I didn't even consider that, Tim Kaine. I thought, you know, cause didn't he give out the stimulus checks? Didn't he sign? What, he won't pay? You're saying people will take the offer, leave their jobs, and then... I was listening to a lawyer who does this, specializes in, you know, federal workers' compensations and things, and said, you know, not only you stepping away now puts your maybe your retirement in jeopardy, your pension in jeopardy. You now have no leg to stand on. If they don't give you the money, if they renege on the money, perhaps, you know, you might end up in a situation where you won't get the money and you won't have your job. Like, just be still. In the midst of chaos, just be still. This is not going to be forever. The worst things that have ever happened didn't last forever. We're here. 866-801-8255. I'll go to the phones, but I wanted to start the show with this and also say that, you know, Mitch McConnell voting no this week, I don't know if it was him voting or somebody voting on his behalf, because I'm not sure if he's all there. But there was a vote cast against this administration's choice for Pete Hegseth. I imagine there's going to be a few more Republicans standing against Robert F. Kennedy, especially after his family has been vociferous. That's not the word for today, but they have been vociferous in their cries to not support his nomination. Matter of fact, Smiz, if we can find Caroline's clip from yesterday, I don't know if you have it. I think it's worth playing again to hear the daughter of JFK and Jackie Bouvier Kennedy talk eloquently about her cousin, who she knows very well. She called him a predator. She laid it out. I mean, it was scathing. Like, ugh. And he's sitting there with his bloated, weird, tan face in front of these people. And Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Michael Bennett, they did their job. We sent them to Congress to stand in the gap for us. But before that happens, your people got to stand up. We all have to stand up and say, this is wrong. And Caroline Kennedy did that. Play it.
I've known Bobby my whole life. We grew up together. It's no surprise that he keeps birds of prey as pets, because Bobby himself is a predator. He's always been charismatic, able to attract others through the strength of his personality, his willingness to take risks and break the rules. I watch his younger brothers and cousins follow him down the path of drug addiction. His basement, his garage, his dorm room were always the center of the action, where drugs were available, and he enjoyed showing off how he put baby chickens and mice in a blender to feed to his hawks. It was often a perverse scene of despair and violence. That was a long time ago, and people can change. Through his own strength and the many second chances he was given by people who felt sorry for the boy who lost his father, Bobby was able to pull himself out of illness and disease. I admire the discipline that took and the continuing commitment it requires. But siblings and cousins who Bobby encouraged down the path of substance abuse suffered addiction, illness, and death. While Bobby has gone on to misrepresent, lie, and cheat his way through life. Today, while he may encourage a younger generation to attend AA meetings, Bobby is addicted to attention and power. Bobby preys on the desperation of parents of sick children, vaccinating his own kids while building a following hypocritically discouraging other parents from vaccinating theirs. Even before he fills this job, his constant denigration of our healthcare system and the conspiratorial half-truths he's told about vaccines, including in connection with Samoa's deadly 2019 outbreak of measles, have cost lives. And now we know that Bobby's crusade against vaccination has benefited him in other ways, too. His ethics report makes clear that he will keep his financial stake in a lawsuit against an HPV vaccine. In other words, Bobby is willing to profit and enrich himself by denying access to a vaccine that can prevent almost all forms of cervical cancer and has already been safely administered to millions of boys and girls.
Elizabeth Warren yesterday or today checked him, Democrat, of course, from Massachusetts, Senator Elizabeth Warren, checked RFK on the very notion that he could profit while sitting in the office, make decisions, which is not unlike Congress being able to insider trade for a later date. We need to revisit that. You should not be able to make laws that also profit your pockets. You should not be able to do that. And we should also, while we're at it, take money out of elections. Elon Musk shouldn't be able to buy an election in these United States. It's pretty, you know, undemocratic.
Next up, we have Joy Reid as she talks with the New York State Attorney General.
So, General James, I want to ask you about an additional lawsuit that New York has joined. And this is suing the Trump administration over their attempt to negate birthright citizenship. We, of course, know that's a constitutional amendment. They can't simply end it. But please describe that lawsuit.
So a lawsuit was filed, again, joining with others in New Jersey. It was filed in Massachusetts. And another case was filed in the great state of Washington. And it basically confirms something which has been an amendment for over 150 years following the Civil War and the in response to the awful Dred Scott decision. And it was confirmed by two United States Supreme Courts. And it basically states the following, that any individual born in these United States should be afforded birthright citizenry. And it's something that has not been undermined for over 150 years until now. Someone who just doesn't understand the contours of the Constitution and someone who doesn't understand that with the stroke of a pen, he thinks that he could somehow undermine the Constitution of these United States. And so it's critically important that, as the judge said in the great state of Washington, that this was blatantly illegal and on its face unconstitutional, and that a member of the Bar Association should not have, he questioned how a member of the Bar Association could possibly argue that an executive order would undermine a constitutional amendment. And I totally agree with the judge. And in the case where we are awaiting a decision in Massachusetts, we are confident that we will get a preliminary injunction in joining the executive order of this president and his administration, which is basically illegal.
Right. And also quite ironic, again, you know, there are many ironies here. I mean, you know, four of Donald Trump's five children, their mothers were immigrants, right? His first three children's mother was an immigrant, and I'm not sure she was a citizen at the time they were born. And, you know, Melania Trump obviously was an immigrant, not sure if she had her citizenship at the time his youngest son was born. And I'm not sure if they are undermining the question of citizenship based on your parents' lineage, how that doesn't apply close to home. You don't have to comment on that if you don't want to, but I just find it ironic. Let me ask you one final question.
Can I just say that there are, please, can I just say that there are two attorneys general who benefit from birthright citizenry, A.G. Tong from Connecticut and A.G. Kwame Raoul from Illinois. And they proudly talk about all of the benefits that they've inherited as a result of being born in these United States, and they're proud of it. And it's the status quo. It is the law of the land. But unfortunately, the president of these United States is not familiar with the Constitution.
Yeah. Last question to you, and this is to go back to the attempt to freeze federal funds coming to the state of New York. And I'm just going to put on the screen, Medicaid accounts for $58 billion that comes back to New York, Health and Human Services, $22 billion, Education, $4.7, Transportation, $2.9, Public Protection, $2.4, and all other funding, $800 million. Federal Medicaid dollars support health care for nearly 7 million New Yorkers, and these federal funds comprise about 36% of New York state budget. But I will note that New York is one of those donor states, a blue state that actually pays more into the federal government than the state gets back. I wonder, is there any way that you can even sort of fathom in your mind how Donald Trump could believe that the federal government could deny a significant donor state the money that it is entitled to by Congress?
No, I can't fathom. It's unfathomable. And it's just, it's shocking. And it's reckless. And what's even worse, Joy, is the fact that he would deny federal funding to California at a time when it is experiencing, these fires, this tragedy, and that he would condition it. And so it's also impacting the state of California, the state of Michigan. They, too, their Medicaid funds, their Medicaid portal was shut off. States all across this nation, their funds were disrupted. And here in the state of New York, we are a donor state. A significant number of the population relies upon these federal funds, direct and indirect funds. And again, the president of the United States does not have power of the purse. That is up to the Congress. And he cannot undermine Congress with the stroke of a pen, just like he cannot undermine a fundamental principle of our Constitution, and that is birthright citizenry.
Attorney General Letitia James, thank you so much.
And finally, folks, we have a segment on Marcus Garvey. Thanks for listening.
Marcus Garvey was born into the racial inequities of the colonial system of Jamaica. He decided to fight for change when he read the autobiography of Booker T. Washington, an educator whose message was self-reliance and self-help through education and economics.
All of those things actually make sense to Garvey in Jamaica. They make sense to a Garvey who's wrestling with the effects of colonialism, racial self-hatred and self-loathing that the colonial system imposed upon black people in Jamaica.
In 1914, while in Jamaica, Garvey organized the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA, to build up racial pride and develop educational and economic opportunities for blacks.
He had these high aspirations for building this worldwide organization to empower people of African descent.
2 years later, Garvey came to the United States and established the UNIA in New York City's Harlem.
There were at least 700 chapters of the UNIA in the United States by 1921 through 1924. There were over 1,000 chapters of the UNIA throughout the world. Garvey was a master showman and a master organizer.
Marcus Garvey was a Caribbean American who would come to reshape the meanings of African America.
Garvey spoke boldly about self-respect and pride in African heritage, a message that appealed to many African Americans frustrated with the violence and disenfranchisement they faced in the United States.
Marcus Garvey obviously has one of the largest mass movements in the 20th century. Definitely the largest of people of African descent.
Garvey and his followers held demonstrations and parades in Harlem to encourage a sense of dignity and identity as a noble people.
Garvey would have these huge parades and he would dress up. And part of that pomp and circumstance was saying, we are a people and we are a coherent people. And then to be a coherent people means that we have rights and we can create a nation.
Shunning integration, Garvey preached a separate African community, complete with black businesses and institutions.
Garvey encouraged the development of black entrepreneurship through the Negro Factories Corporation, which was modeled after Booker T. Washington's National Negro Business League.
The UNIA saw the importance of economics and independent institutions as fundamental to freedom. Garvey's building a set of institutions that are about creating a kind of peoplehood and a nationhood here in the United States.
Part of Garvey's plan was for some African Americans to return to Africa and create a nation there. It was known as the Back to Africa movement.
Marcus, Garvey electrifies much of the African American population throughout the cities of the United States with his Back to Africa movement. Race, men, and women unite, Garvey would say. We are mistreated here. We're going back to Africa. Rise up, ye mighty race.
Garvey started a steamship line called the Black Star Line for trade with Africa and the Caribbean and as transportation for people returning to Africa. The business failed and brought trouble for Garvey.
In 1923, Garvey was arrested for mail fraud because of the sale of the stock of the Black Star steamship line through the U.S. Postal Service. Garvey personally was not involved in any kind of corruption or theft, but unfortunately he was not a good judge of business character.
Marcus Garvey was convicted and sentenced to serve time at a federal penitentiary. President Calvin Coolidge later commuted his sentence, and Garvey was deported from the United States in 1927. He returned to Jamaica as a hero.
Garvey understood that building a black protest movement of black pride, of black ownership and business and self-respect was also a cultural endeavor. And there was a sense of community and cultural identity and an affirmation of African heritage. All of these were part of the UNIA. And it was an extraordinary spiritual and cultural movement.
Marcus Garvey's ideas inspired future black nationalist movements like Nation of Islam, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the Black Panthers.
Everyone has a community, a neighborhood, school, kids' teams, where you worship, work, work out, or any other place or group where you choose to belong. Communities can provide support when you need it, and even when you don't know you do. Like when it comes to preventing underage drinking and other substance use, community members can be your eyes and ears when you're not with your kids and alert you to signs of potential problems. Learn more at talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
You're listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM over the airwaves in the city of Pittsburgh, streaming online to the world up on WRCT.org. Kicking off tonight's experiment here is